You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner with EF Education First and Canyons Ram. Today we are in Pesaro.
Cozze citene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, non spigudeci cora. Cozze citene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Everything have to fall in his place. He was not nervous about that, but yeah, okay. We are new guys this year with the burst. Tosh Kluge is you know already longer, but yeah, to get everything in the right order on the right moment, yeah, that takes some time, and it didn't make him nervous, but okay, definitely everybody want to win, so on a certain point you count all the chances that they are still coming, and today was the last this week, and next week still two to go, so I'm happy that we succeed today.
Good evening, buonasera from Pesaro. My name's Daniel Freeba. I haven't been sacked after yesterday's substandard audio quality on the podcast. The voices you heard there were a familiar voice from the Giro. It was the Caracol commentator who takes a DIY approach to commentary, a bit like my approach to podcasting. And I was in a cafe just beside where the buses were parked. A lot of Colombian journalists in there, including the Caracol commentator. So we got the commentary in real time. Caleb Ewan coming over the line. And after that, you heard the voice of Bart Layson, his director sportif at Lotto Soudal. You're about to hear another voice. It's tonight's mystery guest. After yesterday's very international panel of guests, I've got another very international and very authoritative voice on cycling tonight. It is Brian Neegard, former. Brian, I'm gonna go straight in with the most prominent position you held was as the manager, CEO, team principal of Leopard Trek. You've also worked for Sky as a press officer, CSC before that, chief of communications, I should say, not press officer, not a mere press officer. And after that, Orica Green Edge.
Yeah, now we're here in rainy Le Marche on the Adriatic coast in Pesaro. It's good to be back at the Giro. I haven't done a full one for a while, and yeah, it's my favorite race. And as a long-time fan of the cycling podcast, well, it's great to be on the show finally.
Well, now you're fully qualified because the gamekeeper has turned poacher, or the poacher has turned gamekeeper. You've gone from working in teams to being a journalist. Why? Why would anyone do such a thing?
Because I've been looking from the outside in at how you guys are traveling and doing the races, and it just seemed like a better deal. You know, all that sitting around in the bus and now, to be honest, I'd kind of done the same thing for almost 17 years, and it was time to do something else. And I'd actually quit my job before I had another one, and sometimes that's the best motivation. And then I was approached by Danish TV, so I'm now a commentator on the most of the Grand Tours, not the Giro. And then I'm writing for a Danish newspaper, a more sort of cultural approach to most things, including cycling. And here at the Giro, I'm actually traveling to write a book.
You also deal in art. Deal, that sounds shady. Maybe it is shady. We've never actually gone into that. You sell sculptures. You're a keen wine collector. We're actually drinking some wine at the moment, Brian. What have we got? Because Le Marche, not internationally that well known for its wine, but there's some good stuff, isn't there?
Yeah. There's a lot of good stuff in general in Italy, and you know, part of the beauty of traveling around with the Giro is actually discovering that. And Le Marche, in particular, for me, has some of the most interesting white wines. The Verdicchio, which I think is one of, at least internationally, and maybe not so much here, one of the most undervalued white wines of Italy. Fantastic longevity, great cellaring potential. You should pick up a few bottles if you can.
The Marche is so blessed with beauty, variety and fertility, from sloping mountains that defend, the seas that sweep and embrace, the hills that rise and salute, the valleys that open into smiles. I just came up with that, Brian, just on the spot. Who do you think that was?
I'm not aware of the writer as such. I actually thought it was something that you prepared.
You should know who that was, because it was Giosuè Carducci, who was born in what is now your hometown, Pietrasanta in Tuscany.
Yeah, he's actually the most famous son of the place I call home. And you're right, yeah, Carducci, and he's the claim to fame.
And Brian, reluctantly, we're going to have to talk about cycling. Caleb Ewan finally got his stage win. Caleb Ewan's a guy you worked with, you know well. It was finally the kind of sprint that we thought we were going to see from Caleb Ewan in this Giro, wasn't it? That famous leg speed was in evidence. And I read and I've heard things from various people in the last few days suggesting that Ackermann was clearly superior to the other sprinters in this race, and I expected to see that again today. Not the case.
I always wonder when I hear something like that you can read that someone is superior, because you know they're professional bike riders, but you still don't know actually how they're gonna roll up after those hard stages, and they might not feel the same in two consecutive stages, and it's been obvious for a while, and you can't just judge a bike rider from how they perform on the finish line. If you've seen in general how, at least I think Caleb has been climbing, how he's been positioning himself, I think what you saw on the last climb today, they're all focused, and he's definitely at least as focused as anyone else. But I just saw Caleb today that he was not going to let anyone else win that stage.
And he seems to be, well, he's well on his way to the kind of position or the sort of prominence we thought he'd have in the kind of sprinting hierarchy. But it's taken him a while to get there. Did you always feel, he obviously was highly touted when he turned pro, but did you always feel that he was someone who was destined for the top?
Yeah, first of all, he turned pro at a very young age at a team that had, patience, but also had other priorities. I think it's very hard to keep a sprinter down. It's hard to keep a good sprinter down. And I think eventually he was always going to come around, but everyone have, different development curves, and sometimes sprinters have a different type of patience than the teams do with their results and etc. And I think it's quite typical for a sprinter that they want everything and they want it right now. And I think for Caleb it's just he's been, I think, destined to come around. And I think, that people in general in cycling, they just feel like they should pass judgment about people's ultimate capabilities way too early. We've seen that again and again. We've even seen riders that we've written off come back and still perform at a very high level. And I think with Caleb, sometimes you can't just tell from a rider's physical specifics and abilities how they'll perform, because it all depends on which teams they end up on, which lead out people they have, etc. And if just from sheer talent and speed, Caleb has the goods, and he definitely came up with them today.
Well, we've given the result away, we've given the spoiler is already in the episode, but Brian, we're going to break a second and I'm going to give you the tale of the tapper. Stage 8 and the race headed north for the second straight day, also its longest at 239 kilometres, from Tortoretto-Lido in the Abruzzo region to Pesaro in Le Marche. It ended in a sprint and victory for Caleb Ewan of Lotto Soudal, his first of the Giro this year, and he got it ahead of Elia Viviani and Pascal Ackermann. Earlier in the day, one of Gianni Savio's rolling midfielders, Marco Fraporti, had spent much of the stage in a breakaway with another serial escape artist, Damiano Cina of Nippo Fantini, but they were caught first by Giulio Ciccone, who had counter-attacked to add to his lead on the mountains classification, and then by the peloton. It was a relatively straightforward day for overall leader Valerio Conti of UAE Emirates, who retains his minute and 32 second advantage over Jose Joaquin Rojas on general classification. Ahead of tomorrow's 34.8 kilometre time trial to San Marino, Primoz Roglic is 5 minutes and 24 seconds adrift of Conti, Simon Yates 5 minutes and 59 seconds, Vincenzo Nibali 6 minutes and 3 seconds, and Superman Lopez 6 minutes and 8 seconds. Tomorrow is also, most importantly, this year's wine stage. So Brian, stage win for Caleb Ewan, not much else in terms of action. As far as general classification is concerned anyway, it's we're past the first week now. The race started, of course, a week ago on Saturday in Bologna. How's it been for you? The general consensus is that they've under-egged the pudding, in the sense that we always knew that this first week was not going to be as dramatic as other Giri first weeks because of the course, but I think that probably Maraveni, the race director, when he looks back on this first week and the route in particular, he'll think that he should have probably put in one more sort of, the stages have been difficult, but one more undulating stage, maybe a mountaintop finish.
Yeah, in the sense, you know, in terms of action, they've been putting stuff in the bank that they're hopefully going to, you know, be able to cash out later. We'll see the effects of this first week in the second part of the race, but we've probably been missing a little bit of GC action, you know, specifically other than, you know, the prologue, and is this going to take its toll? Because even if there hasn't been any major climbs until now, it's going to be a very, very hard race on the second half because of this. And then hopefully, you know, tomorrow we'll see the first, we'll be a little bit more able to specifically analyze, you know, how they're doing in terms of who's going to be on the podium. I think we're going to get a relatively clear indication of top five tomorrow.
I was at the start this morning in Tortoreto Lido, and just speaking to a couple of the direct sportives about, you know, how the difficulty is all weighted towards the back of the race. And you know, Max Chandri of Movistar DS was telling me that he reminded his guys this morning, he got the Garibaldi out and he went through the last week and just sort of to highlight again to them how much is still to come in this race. That said, when you speak to the riders, and this is a kind of thing you hear at the end of every first week in a Grand Tour, but everyone is saying how stressful it's been, partly because the race hasn't naturally broken up in the way that, you know, mountaintop finish will always eliminate some guys and then they'll kind of chill out and they'll settle into their roles, but that hasn't really happened.
No, but I think in general, if we want to know everything about what's going to happen and where people are, we should look for another sport. This, I think, I don't mind this type of setup for a 3-week stage race. You know, the stress that it puts on the GC guys and the people who are helping them this first week is immense. You know, they really need a strong group of guys around them, as we see now with, for instance, Simon Yates, with, you know, the likes of Luke Durbridge and Christopher Yule. Dumoulin is out, and that's not because he wasn't well protected, but because he got caught up in a crash. Those dangers in a Grand Tour race are always present at any type of stage. I actually look forward to seeing how this will settle into the race in the second half, because it's been extremely hard this first part without it having any climbs. But I think the stress that they all need to go through, we've all been talking about Simon Yates' ability to sit in the peloton, and I really see him here as a completely changed rider. He's riding with different authority, he's positioning himself really well, he's using his team wisely, and all that is part of what makes him a potential Giro winner again. So I think those details are part of, you know, what I'm liking about it, what I like to see, and I don't think it's uninteresting that we have this start. You know, it'll make for an even better race at the end, I think.
The fastest clothing in the World Tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner with EF Education First and Canyons RAM.
A big thank you to Rafa, who have supported the podcast since 2016 and enabled us to cover the Giro and the other Grand Tours. Rafa have launched their Aero range of clothing, which has been developed in the wind tunnel, looking at all things that make clothing go faster. The range includes an Aero jersey for men and women, Aero suits, and pro team bib shorts. These garments are exactly the same as those being worn by the EF Education First team at this Giro d'Italia. Rafa's Aero range has been developed for years to save you seconds. Check out the full range on rafa.cc. Brian, Aero, suits, bib tights, whatever, it's all going to be in evidence tomorrow. Saving seconds is going to be the name of the game tomorrow. You know, we were just talking about Simon Yates and the Mitchelton Scott team. I think it was interesting, but not unusual for them, that they came to this team with, it was a team heavily weighted to kind of the flat stages, really. A lot of rouleurs in the team, some big guys. It's something that they have tended to do, and it's something that Matt White, the team manager, he's the main director sportif, isn't he? Mitchelton Scott likes to do. In fact, I spoke to him about that this morning. Let's just hear from him now.
I think most teams, if you're dodging bullets, has been the key in this first week, and it's been a pretty stressful week. And even though on paper it looked a pretty easy week, there's been some long days and the weather hasn't been super, so it is wearing people down.
And
Mate, your team generally in Grand Tours, you pick a team that's quite kind of weighted towards the first week, I would say. You know, you always bring enough rulers. Would you say that, you know, this first week has kind of justified that?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of having big guys, big time trial guys, big engines, that because they can save your leaders so much energy. And I've got really good guys here to do that. And now putting Simon as fresh as possible into the TT tomorrow, and obviously the last 10 days of the race is going to be key. And they've done a great job so far. Some teams go a lot heavier with their climbing guys, but we've always had a big chunk of our team as teams time trialers, and now as we've evolved into a GC team, for me they have a very, very important role. So I always go to a Grand Tour with at least three big guys like that.
First big test, I guess, tomorrow, the time trial in San Marino. Did you go and see it in March?
I saw it in March, and then the day before I took Simon and Esteban on the course last Wednesday. So they rode the course on Wednesday, I checked it out in March. It's a nice TT, something for everyone. And I think it's a really good time trial for Simon as well.
With that final climb?
It is. I think we've got 13 kilometres of climbing, so roughly 21 kilometres of flat terrain, very uncomplicated and safe. And then the climb itself goes up in multiple ramps. There's actually two descents on the climb, fast descents, but there's some steep sections above 10%, and I think it's going to... The best climbers are going to do well on here, and I think an all-rounder as well. I think Roglic's definitely the favourite, especially with Dumoulin at home. But I wouldn't be surprised to see Simon right up there in tomorrow's time trial results.
And Matt, when we spoke in Bologna last week and Simon did the now infamous press conference where he said that he was the favourite and that everyone else should be, you know. You said, well, he should be confident. I mean, I know how he's trained for this, how he's prepared. Mm. Still feel that he should be very confident?
100%. The only shame is we've had to wait so long for the big mountains to come. It's been a weird one. I've never been at a Grand Tour where we're waiting until stage 14 to really see the best climbers show their stuff. So you just got to manage it in a different way. And it's been a quiet week for us this week, but I think we're going to see a big ride for him from Simon tomorrow, which is a very good indication of condition, really. There's nowhere to hide on that last 13-14K up to San Marino, and we're going to see where people are really at.
So, Brian, that was your... Well, not exactly your boss, but certainly a colleague of yours.
I still consider Matt White a boss of most things in cycling, even if I'm not on the payroll.
In fact, did you do some recce, some course recce of with Whitey of the Giro stages?
Yeah, I did, actually. It was in the days before Tirreno Adriatico. I went along with Whitey to have a look at some of the stages. I'm not sure if I was of any help, but I was hopefully good company. And I think, for me, now that I work as a journalist and as a commentator, the closer I can be to the main protagonist of the sport, the more I know all that information, it puts me in a better place to actually talk about it. Not in the Giro, because I'm not commentating the Giro, I'm writing about it. But in general, I think if you're a commentator, you need to be as close to the sport and to your sources, which, he is now in a certain way. So I was happy to go along for some of those stages, and I was surprised also to see certain things and certain specifics, how they actually work and how specific they are, in the attempt to win the Giro this year.
Examples?
Well, they're basically having a close look at every single stage, every single kilometer, every single climb. Check, of course you can't check wind directions 2 months out before the race, but you can have a specific look at where it could be a potential danger. And I think if you want to win a Grand Tour, and I think most bike races, apart from some of the classics, it's about ruling out contingencies. You try and rule out every single contingency that can stand in the way of the best performance of your team captain or the rider you want to win with. And this is one way of doing it. And I remember working for Sky, and it was some, because they, to be fair, they came from a very controlled environment, because it was a 250-meter track where there were very few contingencies, and they were trying to bring the elimination of contingencies into road cycling. And that's very integrated now in a lot of teams. And, as much fun that as journalists wanted to make on their behalf when they initiated that, we're working, most teams are working with that now.
And that point, Whitey made in that clip, but I mentioned it earlier, just the sort of balance of riders in the Mitchelton team. Whitey said in that clip that he prefers to have a decent number of big guys in there. You compare that to a team like Astana, which tend to go into races or stage races pretty climber heavy. What do you make of that?
Now that the teams only can bring 8 riders to Grand Tour, they have to select them very, very carefully, depending on which goals they have. You know, and speaking of Caleb Ewan, he hasn't done any Grand Tour stages. Grand Tour races for a while because he didn't fit in a team that were gunning for an overall win, and that's not going to be any less going onwards for those teams. They have to very, very specifically pick their riders. I think the approach that Matt White has, you know, suggested for them is the winning concept, because you can bring a climber or a decent climber, but if they're not there when there's 20 guys left, I'm not really sure how they can contribute. But if you're in trouble in this first part of the Giro, and if you, you know, get caught out, or as we all know, looking at the parcours, it's the climbing counts in the second half, and Simon, you know, can defend himself pretty well. He has, I think, for me, the strongest of all the GC guys, the strongest domestique in Mikkel Neve. I think he's the absolute MVP game changer for him.
Also flying, apparently.
Yeah, as he would be. I think he very rarely misses an appointment performance-wise when he needs to be there. We saw that also last year in the Giro, where he basically won a stage because he felt like it after Simon had the meltdown on the Colle delle Finestre. And I think that if you bring a climber, it needs to be a climber that can actually be there. And when you see how, when Superman Lopez, as you call him,
yeah, I'm glad you respected the official cycling podcast pronunciation.
That's totally caught on with me as well. The way he rides, I'm not really sure that. I mean, he's someone who will potentially drop everyone early if he wants to win the Giro. And I'm not 100% sure how Astana's going to put guys next to him in that game plan. But at the end of the day, you have to give Astana, they haven't really missed much this year, so and everyone's talking about having the strongest team. But if they, you know, if Matt White and those guys bring Simon in a perfect position, he has a job to do on his own tomorrow on the time trial, but if they bring him into a perfect position in the last week, I think they have a great team for that. And if, as long as he has a couple of guys, let's see how Chavez is traveling. He has a very, very strong hand to play.
The cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. All our listeners can get 25% off their Science in Sport products at www.scienceinsport.com by entering the discount code SISCP25. That's all in capital letters, SISCP25. Brian, we were talking about teams before the break there. Primoz Roglic has been the most impressive individual so far in this Giro d'Italia.
Well, most of the season, to be honest.
Well, yeah, he has. But lost Lawrence De Ploes yesterday. At the start this morning, there were a few other sort of people from rival teams remarking on the fact that not only has he lost De Ploes, but his mountain domestiques, what he has in the way of help in the mountains, are not looking that strong. They're certainly not very experienced. So he's got Sepp Kuss, Kurt Bowman, and Antoine Tolhoek. They've not done a huge number of Grand Tours between them. I spoke to Adi Engels, the director sportif of Visma Jumbo, and also to Sepp Kuss himself about the kind of role that he's going to need to play over the next couple of weeks.
I mean, sick, of course, he wasn't 100%. But it was not. I mean, if somebody is sick, he has to go home. And then we tried every day with Lawrence to survive. And he was improving the last days, actually. And he really also yesterday, he said after the stage, I really felt better. But what killed him really was the fight that was going on yesterday for the first 100k. And if the stage would have been like before, that we have earlier a break and a controlled situation, then he would have survived. And he would have survived another day, and then hopefully also today, and then I think with the TT day and the rest day and two flat stages, he would have been back. But we were very unlucky that yesterday was one of those days that nobody was satisfied with any situation, and they kept fighting for 100k, and yeah, he wasn't able to stay in the bunch, and then he was a long time in the car, so I still had hope, but then he was one moment he was out, and then it was over.
So that leaves Primoz with, well, Tolhoek, Kuss, and Bauman as the main sort of mountain domestiques. Obviously, you look at that and you think, well, they're not that experienced at being in this position. I mean, how worried are you about that?
Well, of course, it's a loss now not having Primoz. Not having Laurens. That would be actually a real loss. But. Yeah, I mean it's right what you said. They showed before they for sure have the legs to go a long way, also in the hard and long climbs. But they lack a bit of experience on that board. Also, Laurens actually didn't have, of course, the experience. I think losing Robert on the way to the Giro was a big loss, because he has the experience. But okay, I prefer to have some guys who normally should have the legs than the guys that don't and who have the experience. So normally they should survive the first big selections. And then Primoz is a guy also who has the experience, of course, and who can guide them. And he should coach them a bit. Maybe we can coach them from the car if we are close and see what's going on. And then we have to see. I mean, for sure, I think Antoine had also the best preparation possible towards this race. And Seb was preparing for California, so also altitude, so he should be good as well. So in that way, I'm not too concerned.
Yeah, first of all, it's too bad to lose Laurens, but yeah, it's hard to when in the first stages to see him, not himself and unhealthy, because yeah, we all knew what kind of condition he was in before the race, and you know all the training he put in, so that was tough to see. But yeah, it's not much pressure. Just I think. Yeah, we're all super motivated, and there's no reason why we can't carry on without him. So
this is your second major tour. You did the Vuelta last year. I think it was kind of a grand tour of two halves for you. Good first half, more difficult second half. What are the main lessons that you took from that you're going to try and apply here?
Yeah, I think in the Vuelta, you know, there are certain stages where you think, maybe, you know, you can sit up at a certain amount of time, and you know, because every little bit of energy you can save really adds up in the end. So I think for the Vuelta, it was a combination of that, and you know, all the heat you have in the first week, and really takes it out of you. So
not much heat here.
Yeah, not much heat here yet. And yeah, before the Vuelta, I was already on quite peak form for a while, and yeah, maybe wasn't sustaining that for the whole race. So this race, a bit different, coming in pretty fresh. So yeah, hopefully nice and fresh. Well, relatively.
A lot of young guys in the team, especially in kind of like the mountains division. So you, Antoine, Bauman. How much are you kind of relying on guys like Jos van Emden to sort of guide you through?
Yeah, I mean, we've got a lot of guys, Jos, Paul Martens, Tom Laser, guys that are really experienced, guys that have done this race a lot. Yeah, they're super strong and have the experience. So for us younger guys, we just kind of cue off them and, try to help out as much as we can. But, it's nice to have people with that experience in the race, especially this race.
And just finally, Sepp, everyone in the team says Primoz is a funny guy, but they can't be specific about why he's funny. Tell me a funny story about Primoz.
Oh, man. I'm trying to think. Just, he's just got these one-liners sometimes that you're like, that are just uniquely Primoz. I mean, it's hard to say when you don't know him, but just very nonchalant one-liners. Like there's a video the other day about when he crashed, and he's just certain things just don't faze him, and the way he brushes them off is pretty funny, you know, a lot different than other people might brush misfortunes off.
So, Brian, we heard there from Addy Engels. I sort of challenged him on the fact that he'd told me a bit of a white lie a few days ago. He told me the Plus wasn't ill. The answer he gave today was a little bit more ambiguous. He said, well, he wasn't so ill that he had to go home. But is this a kind of fairly typical thing that teams will decide upon, that, you know, they'll spin a bit of a yarn to the press in order to not show any vulnerability, really?
I think there's probably more than two schools or two approaches to that issue. I think you also need to understand that sometimes the teams will have to strategically put out information. I think to flat out lie, forget about it, that doesn't work. But if they went out and said, yeah, Laurence de Plus is super ill, he might not finish, that's not really helping the interest. I mean, it wouldn't be that big of a worry, because the mountains are still, you know, when he started to not be at his best, there was, you know, it was quite early in the race. He came in hot, as we all saw on San Luca on the opening day. Then and you couldn't say that, oh, he's fine, which I heard on the podcast, you know, one of the DSs said he's fine. He clearly wasn't, and I heard riders also remarking on the fact that he definitely wasn't. It's better just to avoid talking about it than saying a flat-out lie, I would say. But so, the bottom line for the team is they're decimated. But to me, let's see if I'm completely wrong on that in a couple of weeks. I don't see Roglic as a favorite to win the Giro. And I actually, regardless of how well De Plus was traveling, I wouldn't see him as a favorite, just simply judging from the season he's had so far.
And just on that issue of communication, I mean, you say you would avoid, or you would hope to avoid, talking about something like that so as not to expose any vulnerability or weakness. But a rider might get asked about it. Primoz Roglic was in a press conference every day when he had the pink jersey, and it's something that could come up. How did you used to brief riders on that? Was it literally sort of sitting them down before press conferences, or even on the bus in the morning, and say, look guys, if any journalists today ask you about this or that, then this is the line?
I think they're very different scenarios. In general, if there was any issue management, you know, if something had happened, if there was a big breaking news story that involved, you know, problematic issues.
Let's not forget, you were working in an era of professional cycling when there were a lot of problematic issues.
Yes, thankfully, you know, strategic communication was what I think I did best, and I've learned a lot from that. If there was issues management, I would be on the bus, and I would be part of the team briefing so that everyone knew what it was. I think for me, it was more about putting out, letting them know relevant information, and then discussing what an approach was. I think dictating something to a rider, ultimately, it'll last a few days, but I think then generally they also have to understand what the issue is, because then it makes it a little bit easier for them to actually have a proper conversation about it. In another scenario where you have a rider that has the jersey and has it for several days, and I'm seeing that a little bit in Roglic now, and it's not to throw dirt at him at all, but he tends to be a little bit convoluted, and he gives very short, in my opinion, super uninteresting replies to all the questions. And I think he's just a little bit scared that, you know, he might sit with this jersey for another 10 days, and he's worried that stories will develop. But I saw that with Simon Yates last year as well. He didn't give away anything initially, and it wasn't until further on in those, you know, weeks where he had the pink jersey that he started to open up a little bit. But it's not easy either, because, you know, in these days and times with digital media and also with quotes being, you know, translated and passed on, and headlines, and we saw that also with, you know, with Superman Lopez, you know, calling Simon Yates a retard. We saw
Landa. Superman would never say such a thing.
Of course not. It's above him. Obviously it was Landa who said that about the Simon bringing him down in a roundabout. So it doesn't take much for something to, you know, in just the scatological comment taken out of context probably from Simon Yates about him and his competitors, all that, it doesn't take much. And sometimes, you know, I can understand why the riders would rather say less than more.
And as a head of communications for those teams, are you not kind of rubbing your hands when you hear them say nothing? Well, you know, from the point of view of a communications manager, were Primoz Roglic's press conference last week, where he said absolutely nothing, were they not perfect? Is that not textbook?
No, not at all. And I'm not just saying that because I'm on the other side of the fence, if there even is a fence. there's a narrative, and there's, you know, the beauty of cycling compared to football, where I find, you know, I don't follow football as closely as you or Napalm, but I don't really find them saying anything at all. They're very protective about the players and about the messaging. The beauty of cycling is that we're able to actually, that you, we can rock up next to the bus and talk to basically anyone and ask them mostly any question we want. And, you know, that whole spiel of, you know, day by day, I feel good, thank you to my team, I think it wears out, it runs dry pretty quickly in terms of us being able to provide content to our, or interesting angles to our audience. I can't put that in the paper. Usually, actually, now that I'm writing for a relatively intellectual paper, I don't actually have to talk to writers and all that at all. My part as a journalist there is different. But if writers don't give anything away, you'll be trying to actually build something interesting around personalities. And it's easy for me to say now, but what, you know, teams come and go. Writers are the real narrative, and fans, in specifically in cycling, not so much in football, they are fans of bike riders. A little bit teams, but most of all, they identify bike riders they like, they follow the riders they like. And so they actually have to take that narrative seriously and let people as close as they obviously feel they want to. I find riders who give away nothing, they can be as great as they are on the bike, but ultimately I think the fan base and the interest the public will have in them will diminish.
How did you used to deal with riders who simply could not see the interest or the point for them or the derive any enjoyment from speaking to the media?
I think there's two approaches in it, and I don't think you can generalize any of them. I think, you know, a good example with the Yates brothers, if pressed, they would say they would rather not talk to the media. But I think slowly they understand that they have to. I think they will never be a favorite part of what they do, but it's something that you can learn to do in a way where it doesn't take anything away from your recovery, where you can make it a more, at least, natural part of your job. I think if you get a rider to a team when they turn pro and you see that they're potentially going to win big bike races, you try and influence them as much as you can. And I think there's a way to, you know, it sounds really cliche-like, but the best advice you can give to any athlete is if you find a way to be yourself in those situations where you actually find it natural to talk about yourself in a way where you don't feel like you're completely spilling out the intricate details of your private life, but you're actually talking about who you are and how you feel about what you do, then I think that that's absolutely the way forward. You know, people have different skills in terms of talking about themselves. You know, I know that there's other riders of maybe lesser athletic qualities who can talk forever about themselves without actually producing any decent results on the bike, whereas others are really focused at what they do. And I find, you know, specifically with the Yates brothers, they're some of the most focused young athletes I've ever seen in cycling. And I think they're really in it to win bike races. And I think slowly, but quite surely, they are learning the ropes of how it works, you know, with media. And you have to give a little bit away of yourself with the risk of getting a headline here and there that you might not like, but you also learn from it. I think, you know, the debacle of Simon and his rivals being shitting themselves, what's really the problem? You know, there's not a problem. It's only if maybe we've seen too much football that we're worried that there's anything controversial, that I don't think there's anything controversial in what he said.
So, Brian, D-Day tomorrow, or the first big rendezvous of this Giro. I already know the top 18 tomorrow. I've already plotted this. So, Roglic is going to win. Jungle second, Yates third, Campenaerts fourth, Scottson fifth, Nibali sixth, Izagirre seventh, Amador eighth, then Mollema, Kanga, Sivakov, Galopin, Suterlin, Gegenhardt, Ludvigsen, Zakarin, Haga, and Bauli. What do you reckon?
That was quite fast, you know. I'm not.
That's the idea. No one can actually hear the names.
Right. I'm not a native speaker, but where was Superman in all this?
Superman is not. I don't think he'll finish in the top 18. Although, on the flat in the San Luca time trial, he matched Simon Yates. Do you know what? That performance surprised a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh my God, there's a suckling pig.
Rolling a suckling pig next to our table. You could say it's up 20 now and I wouldn't even paying attention.
It's a good job. It's a good job you're not Lionel, because he would no longer be here. He'd have followed the suckling pig into the next room.
Follow the pig.
Yeah, that was the time trial, and Superman's performance on the flat was quite remarkable.
Yeah, so what you're saying now is that you're dead wrong. You have to have Superman in top 18.
Well, listen... I know that. So Mitchelton Scott have kind of extrapolated from that first time trial.
Did you have Nibali in there? Sorry to interrupt.
I had Nibali there. I think he was fifth. Okay. Fifth. But I know that the Mitchelton Scott were kind of budgeting for sort of a minute loss to Dumoulin on the flat tomorrow, and then the last is it 12 kilometres. Climb, go uphill, and they didn't think Simon Yates was going to lose anything there. Obviously, Dumoulin's not around now. Roglic is not quite as strong as Dumoulin on the flat. So I think Yates could finish in the top three tomorrow.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm convinced that he expects to. I mean,
should we find out? Let's see what he expects to do tomorrow. I know you were thinking about maybe a minute to Dumoulin. Roglic isn't quite as good a time trialist.
Oh, that's also a strong claim. We saw already in the prologue, he's really, in great shape. Yeah, and you look at that as well. He took all the time of me in the flat section of the time trial. So there is a long, flattish section in the beginning tomorrow. Of course, we have the climb, but yeah, it's a hard one to judge. I'll do my best. I'm actually looking forward to stepping on the pedals a bit rather than sitting in the bunch.
It's a very different first half of a Grand Tour to your Vuelta last year. I mean, how do your sort of sensations compare at this stage of the Giro?
It's also different to the Giro last year as well. You know, last year we already had stage 6 to Etna, so sensations are good. I got a bit of a banged up left leg, which I'm not super happy about. Hopefully that won't cause me too much pain or whatever in the coming days, especially tomorrow. But it was okay today, so... we'll go from there, really. I feel good, though. Oh, I don't believe I'll ever be as good as those really, specialist sort of, Dumoulin and those guys. But I'm not going to be that level of a time trialist, I'm not able to put out the same amount of power. So, but I've been making, big improvements. And like you said, with Paranese there, it's given me a lot of confidence that I can go to these time trials and do really well. It's the only stage that I previewed. Let's hope that's a good thing. Not much to say, really. It's pretty straightforward. The climb is also pretty solid. Much harder than I was expecting, which is good for me, obviously.
Whether he finishes third or fifth or sixth, it's less relevant than the time loss. The time loss, there's no vanity about him finishing third or fourth on the time trial. Tomorrow, I think it's more a question of how his reference point above and beyond is Roglic. And of course, Whitey and Simon must have calculated a time loss to him that's realistic.
Do you know what Jos van Emden thinks? He thinks that if Roglic rides a perfect time trial, he's going to take 2 minutes off Yates. I don't know if he's ever seen Simon Yates ride a time trial before, but I would suggest that's wide of the mark.
Yeah, I would agree. If Simon is as good as at least most of us thinks he is at the moment, He's not gonna lose 2 minutes. I think he'll still definitely, he'll take a chunk of time, and that's to be expected. But I also think that it's not the time trial tomorrow, nor the one in Verona that's gonna decide the Giro.
Another rider that people might be tipping to win tomorrow, because he's one of the best time trialists in the field, is Victor Campenaerts. However, I don't think he's gonna win. In fact, in my prediction, he was fourth. I also spoke to him after the finish today, just to see exactly what his ambitions for tomorrow are. Victor, the time trial only starts tomorrow, but you're warming up already.
Yes, but that's something I do every day. I cool down on the TT bike, because normally I ride almost every day on the TT bike at home. But in a stage race, we don't do so many TTs. That's why I always cool down on the TT bike. Yeah.
I understand that your big goal for this Giro is the final time trial, but do you have a chance of a stage win tomorrow?
I would like to say yes, but I think no.
Because of the course, because of the, it's over 10 kilometres of climbing, yeah?
Yeah, It's not a super hard climb. We're gonna do a recon now in the car, but still it's climbing. I think I can be better than in the first time trial. That was really specific, but yeah, I think it will be really, really, really hard to make it in the top five.
And just last one, Victor. How has life changed for you in the peloton now that you're a world hour record holder?
You get a lot of respect, of course. All the big champions, they come in and congratulate you. But in the end, you still have to push hard on the pedals.
So anyway, Brian, one thing we do know for sure is that tomorrow we'll be finishing in San Marino. What do you know about San Marino? I've never been there. I'm expecting it to be tacky. It's a tax haven, a duty-free haven. Is it going to be as bad as Andorra? I don't know.
Andorra definitely sets the bar quite high for horrible places in and around bike races.
But you're gonna alienate a lot of your former colleagues with that comment, a lot of bike riders.
No, that's fine. You know, my reference point is a very uninteresting place in Denmark, so I've seen shitty places, you know, from the inside out. But traveling the way I do now, in a different atmosphere with a different goal, I'm watching the race tomorrow from Ravenna. Which not in itself.
Not even going to San Marino.
No, you know why? Because I don't have to. I'm here to write a book.
Not curious.
I'm curious, but there's nothing. You know, I'm not going to see if I'm when sitting in Ravenna, and preparing the book. I'm writing. You know, there's no need for me. I've been at so many finish lines. I've gone to places I have no interest in whatsoever.
None in San Marino. How can you miss an opportunity when your grandchildren ask you? What was San Marino like? You must have gone there in 2019, the famous edition that went to San Marino, and you're not going to know what to respond.
Yeah, I don't expect that future remorse to settle in. So no, I'm not curious, and I think that my curiosity will be limited to what the TV pictures provide us with and what I can read in terms of background. I'll be in Ravenna, as you know, a very, very interesting place in terms of mosaics. It's, you know, one of the places where Lord Byron lived. All things that are a lot more relevant to what I'm doing now, and a book about the culture and the highs and the lows of Italy.
You're a big Italophile. Tell me about why you chose to live in Italy and why you chose Pietrasanta, which is, it's kind of the northwest of Tuscany, isn't it? Quite near the border with Liguria.
Very, very, very correct, Daniel. You know, I came to Italy the first time, the very first time I borrowed money from my older brother. He doesn't listen to this, so he might not come back and claim the debt again. I took the train from Denmark as a young philosophy student, and I went to see the World Championships in Verona in 1999, which features the same climb as the last stage of this year's Giro. And I completely fell in love with the country, not knowing it properly. And I had a friend who was an Erasmus student in Pisa, and I came to visit him, and I think subconsciously I knew that was going to be a place that I was going to be able to live. And luck had it that I was, you know, very soon after that, I was working, you know, I had an offer to work for a team, and I kind of stayed around. And on and off, it's you know, when you work for a professional team, you have a lot of travel days. You've gone for most part of the year, but now I'm not traveling at all in that extent, and I live in what I think now is for me the absolute nicest, friendliest, best part of Tuscany. Tuscany will always be my Italian home in that sense, but it took me a while to find the perfect place, and I really feel that that's Pietrasanta for me.
And why Tuscany, Brian? I mean, everyone, all the Brits, you know, the posh upmarket Brits used to go to Tuscany. Of course, Chianti share, people have probably heard of. Yeah, why did you decide to settle in Tuscany?
I think in you know, Italy, as we see when we travel, you've done the Giro a lot of times as well, is such a country of variation. There's no region that's alike. You know, there's linguistically, historically, culturally, they're all different, but I think Tuscany encompasses all of those things. You know, we have stunning coastline, we have high mountains, we have wine country, there's the culture and the history of it in itself.
Lovely accent.
It's the Italian accent, isn't it?
It's the Italian accent. I mean, if I was to be critical, it always sounds as though, Tuscans always sound as though they're about to sneeze when they talk.
But that's a very Florentine Tuscan accent. It's not the Pisan accent nor the Pietrasantese.
But it's endearing. It is very endearing. And Brian, Before we go, I mentioned you're a keen collector of wine. Richard and Lionel will be. Well, they'll be glad that I hope the audio has been better tonight, better quality, but also that we just haven't spent 40 minutes talking about wine. But you must have drunk some good wine on this Giro. I mean, it's one of the absolute glories of the Giro, isn't it? We get to physically visit a lot of different wine producing regions. Tell me about some of the good stuff you've had on this Giro.
I've actually not been front loading as much as I thought I would, because I've been driving a car a lot, so I've stayed pretty limber as of now. So it's all in front of me. I prepared a stopover in Lange, in La Mora, close to Barolo, and that's where I'll be doing my sort of deep immersion into some of the Italian wines that I love the most. I think this is also about discovery, you know. And I'm not traveling this Giro to confirm everything that I know on beforehand and everything that I want to see that I've seen before. So actually, I've delved into some pretty rare wines. Even I have no idea what we're drinking right now, even if we're on our second glass. It's a Bianchello del Metauro. I'd have to say that's a first for me. It's a white wine, and that's now actually pretty warm. The last sip I had. I think it's the beauty of the Giro is discovering things that you haven't seen before, and including some of the local grapes that will never go anywhere else. You probably couldn't drink them any other place because they make so little of it that they just serve it in the local restaurants.
And we've still got the wine stage to come. It's not the greatest wine stage. In fact, it's tomorrow. What am I talking about? It's I think they're just calling it the Sangiovese stage. The Sangiovese, of course, being the main red grape that's used in the centre of Italy. It's a bit ubiquitous, isn't it? It's pretty, like, the majority of the wines made in the centre of Italy are made from the Sangiovese grape. But we'll be drinking some tomorrow, and can't wait to see what happens on GC. It's going to be interesting. Brian, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.